Last time we began the chapter, which was retitled Equality and Knowledge. In the Arya, it appeared as Knowledge and Equality. It was published on the 15th of March, 1918. As Sri Aurobindo said in that first sentence, yoga and knowledge are, in this early part of the Gita's teaching, the two wings of the soul's ascent. And he's demonstrating, one paragraph at a time, how integrally they connect with each other and how they impact our lives as we move to make real here in the flesh what the truths of the spirit are. He left us, or we cut away from the essay, rather, when he had just cited something from the Mundaka Upanishad, a phrase, yasmin vijñāte sarvam vijñātam, living out the union with the Supreme, whose truth being known, all is known. It all comes from identity of being. Knowledge in a Vedantic sense is not simply the questing of the intellect to pull into itself information from the several layers of the world, but rather to focus first on that essence in which all things arise, by which they are sustained, and to which they pass. And this reality is all-encompassing. In fact, it is beyond the compassing of things. It is an essence as well as a universal reality, and both essence and universality are stationed within the heart of the individual. So, we begin, the higher knowledge we then get is that which is to the knower of Brahman, his constant vision of things when he lives uninterruptedly in the Brahman. Brahmavid Brahmani Stitaha. Keeping track as we go, that's in chapter 5, shloka 20. That is not a vision or knowledge or consciousness of Brahman to the exclusion of all else, but a seeing of all in Brahman and as the self. So if we look at Gita 6:32, we find that equality is what the supreme yogin has to distinguish that attainment from all others. For it is said, the knowledge by which we rise beyond all relapse back into the bewilderment of our mental nature is, quote, that by which thou shalt see all existences without exception in the self, then in me. 4:35. So, not to fall back into the divisive nature of the whirlwind universe requires us first to attain the consciousness of the Atman, Brahmastiti. But based upon that, one can rise to an even greater height of knowledge and identify with the Supreme as the universal person. All existences, without exception, in the self. So when we see the world, we see essentially the divine everywhere we look, and all beings are placed within that enormity, that wonder of existence. But then something else proceeds beyond simply this impersonal placement of all within that. We recognize the person behind. We see not simply the Godhead, but the God. Elsewhere, the Gita puts it more largely. Equal visioned everywhere, he sees the self in all existences and all existences in the self. He who sees me everywhere and all and each in me is never lost to me, nor I to him. He who has reached oneness and loves me in all beings, that yogin, howsoever he lives and acts, is living and acting in me, O Arjuna. He who sees all equally everywhere as himself, whether it be happiness or suffering, I hold him to be the supreme yogin. That's chapter 6, shlokas 29 through 32, and we'll end the chapter basically with a return to that. It is key to this equation of knowledge and equality. Sri Aurobindo continues, that is the old Vedantic knowledge of the Upanishads, which the Gita holds up constantly before us, but it is its superiority to other later formulations of it that it turns persistently this knowledge into a great practical philosophy of divine living. Always it insists on the relation between this knowledge of oneness and karma yoga, and therefore on the knowledge of oneness as the basis of a liberated action in the world. And this, of course, is a demarcation between the schools of sannyasins who have hide away into the frosty altitudes of Brahman, but left the worlds as they were. For Sri Aurobindo, one has to have the attainment of the Brahman consciousness and continue to live in the world at the same time. And this is the teaching of the Gita, not just Sri Aurobindo. Sri Aurobindo points out often that the Gita restores the active dimension of spirituality to Indian life. We remember the context in which the Gita was arising. There was a movement across many sections of India through Buddhism and Jainism to turn away from the world, to regard it as a field of suffering and to abandon it. And spiritual eyes were not supposed to be fixed upon the vagaries of the world's life. But the Gita arose and addressed it directly. It said, no, return to the world. And Arjuna, in a sense, represents all of us as we work in the world, in dialogue with the divine continually. Whenever it speaks of knowledge, Sri Aurobindo writes, it turns at once to speak of equality, which is its result. Whenever it speaks of equality, it turns to speak too of the knowledge which is its basis. The equality it enjoins does not begin and end in a static condition of the soul, useful only for self-liberation. It is always a basis of works. The peace of the Brahman in the liberated soul is the foundation. The large, free, equal, worldwide action of the Lord in the liberated nature radiates the power which proceeds from that peace. These two, made one, synthesize divine works and God knowledge. And now we enter a paragraph in which we see coming into fusion Sri Aurobindo's own iteration of the integral yoga in its earliest formulation in what he called in his notebook Sapta Chatushtaya, the seven quartets, in which he enumerates that the first Chatushtaya, the first element of his yoga, is based on peace. And what are the three elements of peace? Titiksha, Udasinata, Natthihi Itta, Samatha. All these three, Titiksha, Udasinata, and Natthi, comprise equality at different levels of attainment as we move from one to the other, a progressive capturing of the whole being into what is the oneness of the world. So he continues, we see at once what a profound extension we get here for the ideas which otherwise the Gita has in common with other systems of philosophic, ethical, or religious living. Endurance, philosophic indifference, resignation are, we have said, the foundation of three kinds of equality. But the Gita's truth of knowledge not only gathers them all up together, but gives them an infinitely profound, a magnificently ample significance. So endurance is titiksha. Philosophic indifference is udasinata. And resignation is natthi. And of course, this is the Gita's truth. Sri Aurobindo is drawing from these insights in the Gita when they comprise themselves in his own integral yoga. So there is a deep historical connection between the Vedanta as expressed in the Bhagavad Gita and what Sri Aurobindo manifests in a new order of yogic endeavor, which recaptures the world and continues the evolution beyond the triple world of mind, life, matter into something new. So this power embedded in Vedanta, seen in the Gita, is a promise for the future. The Stoic knowledge is that of the soul's power of self-mastery by fortitude, an equality attained by a struggle with one's nature, maintained by a constant vigilance and control against its natural rebellions. It gives a noble peace, an austere happiness, but not the supreme joy of the liberated self living not by a rule, but in the pure, easy, spontaneous perfection of its divine being, so that, however it may act and live, it acts and lives in the divine. Because here, perfection is not only attained, but possessed in its own right, and has no longer to be maintained by effort, for it has become the very nature of the soul's being. So that's, again, 631. He's translated it above, and it appears again. So right now, he's talking about endurance. He's talking about titiksha. The Gita accepts the endurance and fortitude of our struggle with the lower nature as a preliminary movement. But if a certain mastery comes by our individual strength, the freedom of mastery only comes by our union with God, by emerging or dwelling of the personality in the one divine person, and the loss of the personal will in the divine will. There is a divine master of nature and her works, above her, though inhabiting her, who is our highest being and our universal self. To be one with him is to make ourselves divine. By union with God, we enter into a supreme freedom and a supreme mastery. The ideal of the Stoic, the sage who is king, because by self-rule he becomes master also of outward conditions, resembles superficially the Vedantic idea of the self-ruler and all-ruler, Swarat, Samrat, but it is on a lower plane. The Stoic kingship is maintained by a force put upon self and environment. The entirely liberated kingship of the yogin exists naturally by the eternal royalty of the divine nature, a union with its unfettered universality, a finally unforced dwelling in its superiority to the instrumental nature through which it acts. His mastery over things is because he has become one soul with all things. So this is a very different kind of royalty than the enforced mastery of the Stoic, who has to conquer nature through the force of nature. It is as if it is possible for someone to become so mightily sattvic that they can subdue all three gunas, to use the Gita's language, that would be the achievement of the Stoic. The Gita aims at something vaster. So, to take an image from Roman institutions, the Stoic freedom is that of the libertus, the freed man, who is still really a dependent on the power that once held him enslaved. His is a freedom allowed by nature because he has merited it. The freedom of the Gita is that of the free man, the true freedom of the birth into the higher nature, self-existent in its divinity. Swayambhu. Whatever he does, and however he lives, the free soul lives in the divine. He is the privileged child of the mansion, Balavat, who cannot err or fall because all he is and does is full of the perfect, the all-blissful, the all-loving, the all-beautiful. The kingdom which he enjoys, Rajyam Samriddham, is a sweet and happy dominion of which it may be said, in the pregnant phrase of the Greek thinker, the kingdom is of the child. Well, we've met this before. He's speaking about Heraclitus here. The kingdom is of the child. He's also translated this a year or so earlier in the synthesis in the chapter on Gnosis and Ananda, 15 November 1917. So this idea that the kingdom is of the child, you'll remember what we, I guess most of us first met in Thoughts and Glimpses, was published as an aphorism in the Arya in May 1915, and it says, "What is God, after all? An eternal child playing an eternal game in an eternal garden." So the idea of the joyful child, regnant in the kingdom, it is his, and he plays and delights as he plays. And Rajyam Samriddham, a phrase from chapter 11, shloka 33, it means unrivaled kingdom. So a child at sport. The knowledge of the philosopher is that of the true nature of mundane existence, the transience of outward things, the vanity of the world's differences and distinctions, the superiority of the inner calm, peace, light, self-dependence. It is an equality of philosophic indifference, udasinata. It brings a high calm, but not the greater spiritual joy. It is an isolated freedom, a wisdom like that of the Lucretian sage, high in his superiority upon the clifftop, whence he looks down on men tossed still upon the tempestuous waters from which he has escaped, in the end something, after all, aloof and ineffective. So Lucretian sage, this is Lucretius, you know, the nature of all things, is epic in Latin. The Gita admits the philosophic motive of indifference as a preliminary movement, but the indifference to which it finally arrives, if indeed that inadequate word can be at all applied, has nothing in it of the philosophic aloofness. It is indeed a position as of one seated above, Udasinavat, but as the divine is seated above, having no need at all in the world, yet he does works always and is present everywhere, supporting, helping, guiding the labor of creatures. This equality is founded upon oneness with all beings, ekatva. The phrase Udasinavat in the Gita is chapter 9, shloka 9. This equality is founded upon oneness with all beings. It brings in what is wanting to the philosophic equality. For its soul is the soul of peace, but also it is the soul of love. It sees all beings without exception in the divine. It is one self with the self of all existences, and therefore it is in supreme sympathy with all of them. Without exception, Asheshena, not only with all that is good and fair and pleases, nothing and no one, however vile, fallen, criminal, repellent in appearance, can be excluded from this universal, this whole-souled sympathy and spiritual oneness. This is chapter 4, shloka 35. Here, there is no room, not merely for hatred or anger or uncharitableness, but for aloofness, disdain, or any petty pride of superiority. A divine compassion for the ignorance of the struggling mind. A divine will to pour forth on it all light and power and happiness there will be indeed for the apparent man. But for the divine soul within him, there will be more. There will be adoration and love. For from all, from the thief and the harlot and the outcast, as from the saint and the sage, the beloved looks forth and cries to us, "This is I, he who loves me in all beings." What greater word of power for the utmost intensities and profundities of divine and universal love has been uttered by any philosophy or any religion? Well, that's chapter 6, shloka 31. Sarva bhute stitam. In all beings. So that is the nature of being seated above in the self, but including all within that. Now we move to resignation, natthi. Resignation is the basis of a kind of religious equality, submission to the divine will, a patient bearing of the cross, a submissive forbearance. In the Gita, this element takes the more ample form of an entire surrender of the whole being to God. It is not merely a passive submission, but an active self-giving. Not only a seeing and an accepting of the divine will in all things, but a giving up of one's own will to be the instrument of the master of works, and this not with the lesser idea of being a servant of God, but eventually at least of such a complete renunciation both of the consciousness and the works to him that our being becomes one with his being, and the impersonalized nature only an instrument and nothing else. So the lesser idea, being a servant, because there's a separation of being, this is the numinous relationship of the aspirant with the divine. But then becoming one with that being, impersonalized, lifted beyond the limits of personality. This is the mystic experience. This is the oneness of being, which is true knowledge, knowledge by identity. There is, all result, good or bad, pleasing or unpleasing, fortunate or unfortunate, is accepted as belonging to the master of our actions, so that finally not only are grief and suffering born, but they are banished. A perfect equality of the emotional mind is established. There is no assumption of personal will in the instrument. It is seen that all is already worked out in the omniscient prescience and omnipotent effective power of the universal divine, and that the egoism of men cannot alter the workings of that will. Therefore, the final attitude is that enjoined on Arjuna in a later chapter. All has been already done by me in my divine will and foresight. Become only the occasion, O Arjuna. Nimitta matram bhava savyasachin. That's at 11:33. A mere instrument be. This attitude must lead finally to an absolute union of the personal with the divine will, and with the growth of knowledge, bring about a faultless response of the instrument to the divine power in knowledge, a perfect and absolute equality of self-surrender, the mentality, a passive channel of the divine light and power, the act of being, a mightily effective instrument for its work in the world, will be the poise of this supreme union of the transcendent, the universal, and the individual. So here again we see this fusion of equality and knowledge now stationed in all three terms of being, in the transcendent, from which the universe comes and which is stationed in the individual. Equality, too, there will be with regard to the action of others upon us. Nothing that they can do will alter the inner oneness, love, sympathy, which arises from the perception of the one self in all, the divine in all beings. But a resigned forbearance and submission to them and their deeds, a passive non-resistance, will be no necessary part of the action. It cannot be, since a constant instrumental obedience to the divine and universal will must mean, in the shock of opposite forces that fill the world, a conflict with personal wills which seek rather their own egoistic satisfaction. Therefore, Arjuna is bidden to resist, to fight, to conquer. But to fight without hatred or personal desire or personal enmity or antagonism, since to the liberated soul these feelings are impossible. To act for the loka sangraha, impersonally, for the keeping and leading of the peoples on the path to the divine goal, is a rule which rises necessarily from the oneness of the soul with the divine, the universal being, since that is the whole sense and drift of the universal action. going back to chapter 3, shloka 25 for that. Nor does it conflict with our oneness with all beings, even those who present themselves here as opponents and enemies. For the divine goal is their goal also, since it is the secret aim of all. Even of those whose outward minds, misled by ignorance and egoism, would wander from the path and resist the impulsion. Resistance and defeat are the best outward service that can be done to them. By this perception, the Gita avoids the limiting conclusion which might have been drawn from a doctrine of equality impracticably overriding all relations and of a weakening love without knowledge, while it keeps the one thing essential unimpaired. For the soul, oneness with all. For the heart, calm, universal love, sympathy, compassion. But for the hands, freedom to work out impersonally the good, not of this or that person only, without regard to or to the detriment of the divine plan, but the purpose of the creation, the progressing welfare and salvation of men, the total good of all existences. So, to hold together the world from oneness and knowledge, equality to all, and yet serving the divine will in each moment and each circumstance. Oneness with God. Oneness with all beings. The realization of the eternal divine unity everywhere, and the drawing onwards of men towards that oneness are the law of life which arises from the teachings of the Gita. Ekatvam astita, seated in oneness. There can be none greater, wider, more profound. Liberated oneself to live in this oneness, to help mankind on the path that leads towards it, and meanwhile to do all works for God, and help man also to do with joy and acceptance all the works to which he is called. Krishna karma krit, sarva karmani joshayan. No greater or more liberal rule of divine works can be given. The first Sanskrit there, Krishna Karmakrit, that's 418, and the second is 326. Actually reading Joshayet Sarva Karmani. In other words, should engage in all actions. Krishna Karmakrit, the doer of all deeds. Become that. This freedom and this oneness are the secret goal of our human nature and the ultimate will in the existence of the race. It is that to which it must turn for the happiness all mankind is now vainly seeking when once men lift their eyes and their hearts to see the divine in them and around, in all and everywhere, sarveshu, sarvatra, and learn that it is in him they live, while this lower nature of division is only a prison wall which they must break down, or at best, an infant school which they must outgrow, so that they may become adult in nature and free in spirit. To be made oneself with God above, and God in man, and God in the world, is the sense of liberation, and the secret of perfection. He who established in oneness, worships me in all beings. That yogin lives in me, whatever may be his mode of living. 631. And the sense of this oneness everywhere, this idea of the all in the one, it ranges through the Gita, 257, 629, 631 and 2, 1327. I could cite for quite some time and not cover it all. But we have read through equality and knowledge now, and I think we understand that oneness is what we aim for in the essence of our being, but a oneness established here. As we are, working out the divine will as we go. So, here's a section towards that end from Savitri, Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother, in Canto 3, the House of the Spirit in the New Creation, and we begin at the bottom of page 322. Then suddenly there came a downward look, as if a sea exploring its own depths, a living oneness widened at its core and joined him to unnumbered multitudes. A bliss, a light, a power, a flame-white love caught all into a soul immense embrace. Existence found its truth on oneness' breast, and each became the self and space of all. The great world rhythms were heartbeats of one soul. To feel was a flame discovery of God. All mind was a single harp of many strings, all life a song of many meeting lives, for worlds were many, but the self was one. This knowledge now was made a cosmos seed. This seed was cased in the safety of the light. It needed not a sheath of ignorance. Then, from the trance of that tremendous clasp, and from the throbbings of that single heart, and from the naked spirit's victory, a new and marvelous creation rose, incalculable, outflowing infinitudes, laughing out an unmeasured happiness, lived their innumerable unity. Worlds where the being is unbound and wide, bodied unthinkably the egoless self, rapture of beatific energies, joined time to the timeless, poles of a single joy. White vasts were seen where all is wrapped in all. There were no contraries, no sundered parts. All by spiritual links were joined to all and bound indissolubly to the one. Each was unique, but took all lives as his own, and following out these tones of the infinite, recognized in himself the universe. A splendid center of infinity's whirl, pushed to its zenith's height, its last expanse, felt the divinity of its own self-bliss, repeated in the numberless other selves. It took up tirelessly into its scope persons and figures of the impersonal, as if prolonging in a ceaseless count, in a rapturous multiplication's sum, the recurring decimals of eternity. None was apart, none lived for himself alone. Each lived for God in him and God in all. Each soulness inexpressibly held the whole. There, Oneness was not tied to monotone. It showed a thousand aspects of itself. Its calm, immutable stability upbore on a changeless ground forever safe, compelled to a spontaneous servitude, the ever-changing, incalculable steps, the seeming reckless dance's subtle plan of immense world forces in their perfect play. You'll see the section goes on, and you can read it for yourselves. Well, thanks for joining. I know that the 24th is coming soon, and we'll have our programs here in Pensacola, and no doubt you'll have yours there. And here in America, it'll be centered around Thanksgiving, or rather, Thanksgiving will be an ornament sitting on City Day. However you like to see it. But I look forward to seeing you. Shrestham. Namaste. Jai Ma.